Access number 27796 is the Harry Irons Reel 5. Now, we're just going through your logbook, really, looking at some of the raids that you remember. You know. Yeah. Now, what else do you remember?
The next raid was Lorraine in France. I don't know much about that. I don't think it was... there's quite a bit of flak over the town, but we headed it. We came in from the sea, done our bombing run, and come back over the sea. So it wasn't too much problem. The following day, we went to Milan, Italy. That was a night operation. It was all I remember about that. It was it's a very, very cold journey, especially in the rear turret. And then on the 18th of the 2nd, we went away on leave. And on the 18th of the 2nd, we went to Wilhelmshaven. And that is where the flak was very, very heavy. But fortunately, we approached it from the sea and done the same as what we'd done in Lorraine. We headed straight over the target and put the nose down, headed straight out to sea. But I did notice then, from the beginning of the new year, the opposition had really increased. There was many, many more fighters, especially single engine ones. And what they was doing now, they was making a corridor of flares on the approach of the target. So when they found out exactly which way you was heading, they had aircraft out there dropping huge white flares on the approach. So as you headed into the target, it was like daylight. And the fighters were mixing amongst, were coming down. You could see them coming in, attacking the bombers. From there, we went to Bremen. I think this is all apart, all these Atlantic and Baltic towns was all a part of the trying to curb the submarines a little bit. We can see where Bremen, Wilhelmshaven and Lorraine. On the 25th of the 2nd, we went to Nuremberg, and that was a long, long journey. Dangerous one as well. Completely over Germany. We met to see a few fighters, we dodged a few fighters, but we weren't fired on. But it was the same thing was happening there. The Pathfinders were beginning to become a force, and they was going in first. Consequently, the main force that was coming up behind, the Germans, by the time we got to the target, and the Pathfinders had dropped their flares, the time we got to the target, it was already really livened up, and the ACAC and the opposition searchlights was beginning to get terrifying. From there we went to Cologne in Happy Valley. I can't say much about it. All I know about that is that it's the flak there was flak everywhere, but there, especially in the Ruhr Valley, because there was about six or seven towns all clustered together, and they all used to give you a walloping as you went in. From there we went to Munich again. I went there previously with Stubbs, and we got badly shot up by a Ju-88. In fact, we were lucky to get back. And then we done mining. Now, this mining, I must mention mining.
Tell us about that.
Yeah, this is interesting. It was always seen as an easy trip. After you'd done a few heavy trips, you know, bad trip, they used to give you a mining trip. That was going over the Baltic, flying about 4,000 feet and dropping these metallic mines of about 1,000 pounds. And all you used to get a point in the area and then just drop them. They used to come down by parachute and gradually sink in the sea. But the losses from these mining operations was enormous, because the simple reason was what the Jerrys were doing was having what they call flak ships in the sea, in the Baltic, and they used to just wait there, and they used to wait for the bombers, because the bombers were coming in low and slow, because they had to go in slow because of the mines. You couldn't drop them at great height or great speed because they'd burst, and that's when these flak ships used to be waiting for them, and they shot down so many, it's unbelievable. And that's what they used to call the easy trip. On the 12th we went to Essen, the Happy Valley again, which was Well, I don't have to mention it because I've mentioned it already, but it was getting worse. The opposition was really, really getting bad. This was in a matter of from August 42 to March 43, and it was getting really, really fierce. And again, I noticed how many fighters were flying about, and I was getting more and more experienced and more deadly. From there, we went to France again, and we done Saint-Nazaire. Then I went on to do a bit of training on Manchester's and on a new cine. They were trying out a new gun sight, and we had to go and practice it on the Manchester's.
Now, where was that at? Was that from your airfield? Or
no, it was from. I wonder if I got. I don't think I got the.
Was that the end of your tour then?
No, it wasn't the end of my tour. No, this was during my tour. Apparently, they got a new gun sight out, and there was a. The more experienced blokes were taking it up in the air and fly, and having cine, having aircraft Spitfires coming at us, and we're taking cines of it, and we see if the gun sight was any improvement.
And was it? I do not remember.
I don't remember. I know we still had the same gun sight. We still had the same aircraft. And then, believe it or not, we went back to Essen again. On the 3rd of the 4th. And the 4th of the 4th, Operations Kill. Same thing again, after the submarine bases. And that was the end of my first tour.
Now, how did you feel on the last couple of missions? You must have known.
He was very, very, very nervous. I mean nervous, because from the actual original squadron in August, we were the only crew that was still flying, as apart from all the rest that got. But from the original, when we transferred from Wellington's onto Lancaster's, we was the only crew left at the originals. But we'd lost so many. We'd lost I think we lost nearly 60 aircraft that year, and we was the only crew left. We was the most experienced crew there, and we was asked to go on pathfinding, but two of the crew were married. Well, one of the crew was married, and the other one didn't fancy it, so we said we wouldn't, if we couldn't go as a full crew, we wouldn't go at all.
So at the end of your tour, they asked you to do an immediate second tour. What happened?
On pathfinding.
Straight away.
No gap. You guys go straight on pathfinding. They give you a increase in rank. If you're a sergeant, you become a flight sergeant, and if you're a pilot officer, you become a flying officer. And you go. You do. The idea was you do another 15 straight off. You're in this. The three special squadrons, and they used to go in first, dropping the marker flares. But I think two or three of the crew didn't want to go, and the pilot said, "Well, we're still all sergeants, we're still NCOs." They said, "Well, we won't go if we don't go as a full crew," and that was it.
And how did you feel? I mean, did you want to go on path, or would you rather?
Well, not really. I would have gone but it was horrendous. I tell you, we can't explain it because it was absolutely horrendous. And it was getting worse and worse every night. Because the only thing that really saved us, I think, was the amount of leave they gave us. We used to get 7 days every 3 weeks. So every 3 weeks you've got 7 days. And you come. But when you come back after 7 days, you look around the mess and you see so many new faces, you would not believe that you was in the same squadron. That's what the losses were. They were enormous. I suppose it was all every squadron.
So what happened to you next then? What happened to your crew, in fact? I mean, did you?
Well, the crew, as far as I know, they all went on OTU. Me and the pilot and the navigator from the previous aircraft, the Stubbs, we all went to Cottesmore. As instructors on
at Cottesmore.
Yeah, Cottesmore. It's 14 OTU Cottesmore.
And at Cottesmore, C O D I S?
No, C O T T E S M-O-R-E. And I've become an instructor there. What we used to do, when it's called pupils, as they come off of their training schools, like a navigation school, gunnery schools, not flight engineers, pilots, bomb aimers, they all met. Each course met in the mess, and they'd be drinking, and then they'd sort out each other for a crew. None of them knew each other, but they said, "Are you a navigator? Would you like to fly with me?" And that's how they made up their crews. And the following morning, they was in their crews on parade, and us instructors would sort them out. Like me being the instructor for gunnery, I'd take the gunners, and the bomb aimer would take the bomb aimers. Or sometimes we took the whole crew on trips, night flying trips, and bombing trips, gunnery trips, navigation trips. And that course lasted about 3 months.
Now, that was from when to when? When would that be? When do you start with that?
I started on June 43. And that went on to August. Then went on to October, 24th of October.
43. Yeah. What was it like being an instructor? I mean, you know.
Well, it was very, very, very dicey. I'll tell you why. That very, very old Wellington aircraft, the original ones, and it was really clapped out. Well, you can imagine, there was probably about six or seven different crews flying them every day, and had a hell of a lot of accidents here. But the thing I could never understand, how they sent them young lads with no experience whatsoever on bombing raids. To make the number up and bomb a command, they should say OTU crews. And they were just freshmen, you know, just finished their gunnery and had a few trips on the one instance. And then they sent them over on bombing raids. And their losses were enormous.
And did you ever go on one of them?
No, I never went on one. I don't know why I never went on one. I think I was a bit... you could see what was going on. There was the losses on these training command, it's unbelievable. Because all the aircraft were really old, clapped out bombers. And yet they sent these kids, or youngsters, you know, with no experience whatsoever, over to Germany on bombing raids. Very experienced, but it's ridiculous, really, because they should never have sent them.
Did you ever have any trouble with these old Wellingtons? I mean, you know, any close shows or
well, a few crashed. Sometimes, the mistake they used to make, a lot of the new pilots, instead of selecting the wheels on takeoff, they used to select the flaps. So consequently, the aircraft just went straight on the belly. That happened several times. A lot of them got lost. Well, the navigators were pretty raw. I don't think they had G on the... I don't think they had the G on OTUs. And we was different. We was instructors, and we knew them well, but we were more or less kept apart from the students. But we, us instructors, because it was all first tour men or second tour men.
I'm still a sergeant.
Yeah.
Anything else? Now, anything happening? That it's about 4 months, isn't it?
Yeah. Not really. No, we just done the training. It was pretty mundo. You know, we used to go out, take them up every day, and we used to take them on the firing range and show them how to. Mind, I was getting more experience as well, because I was training more or less training with them, and I could see. It's amazing that when you've done a little bit yourself. When somebody comes along that hasn't done it, how raw they really are, you know, the mistakes they make. Still, I was only still just turned 18 then. Anyway, from there, what I was going to do was I'm going to get all the instructors from the gunnery schools and put them on ops and put first tour operators up in the gunnery schools as instructors. which we did. We went to Evanton up in Scotland. It was the initial gunnery school. These young lads had never hardly flown, and they were just learning the gunnery, you know, basic gunnery.
So that's at Evanton?
Evanton, that was in just outside Inverness.
E-V-A, how do you spell it?
E-V-A-T-O-N.
No N, E-V-A-T-O-N.
Yeah.
And when did you go there, October?
Yeah, around about October, yeah.
And did it have a number, the initial gunnery school? I mean,
yeah, number 8. Number 8, air gunnery school.
Air gunnery school or yeah. Initial gunnery school?
No, air gunnery school. And
now, what were you doing there?
Well, I was showing the gunners deflection, mostly. How to control the turret. And taking them up on air firing against rogues. But the only thing was, they was using Ansons. Now, to me, there's no way could they, you know, know what was going to happen to them, because the Anson wasn't a bomber at all. But it had a turret in the back. And if I remember rightly, we used to have to wind the wheels up by hand on the Ansons. It wasn't hydraulic. I remember you still had to wind the wheels up with a crank them up. But they only had one turret in it, and they weren't suitable for what they were. Anyway, from there, they used to go to OTU, and they spent another 3 months here, gunnery.
So anything happening up at Evanton?
Nothing really. No, not really. It's just training. And what happened, all of us, from out of the blue, they said, we want all you, that's half a dozen of us, to go to Hunton Grandswick, 291 Squadron, Hunton Grandswick, to fly drogues and co-op with the army. Apparently, they was having these martinets flying during the day, towing these drogues, and there was being attacked by fighters. But why they wanted air gunners in the back of them, I don't know, because we couldn't have done nothing. We had no guns or nothing. But we were flying these drogues along the coast.
So you were flying the martinets, yeah. Pulling the drogues?
Yeah, pulling the drogues, yeah.
And anything happened? That was at Hunton Grandswick?
That's right, yeah. I think that's up in Yorkshire somewhere.
And when were you there from?
6th of the 4th, 44.
So you'd been at Evanton till April-ish or March.
That's right, yeah. And what it was really, it was co-op with the, it was drogue time for the army, for their ACAC. The idea wasn't to, we had to measure them or not tell them, actually, the drogue, they didn't want to fire on the drogue because they kept on blind shooting them down. So what they used to do, mate, fire them about 4 or 5 degrees off, long as I was in line with the drogue, they used to call it a direct hit.
And anything happened while you were with the that's on the martinets?
Yeah, nothing happened really. It was pretty. And then they posted me to 567 Squadron at Detling. I was a flight sergeant.
Detling?
Yeah. Detling. I was a flight sergeant then, doing exactly the same thing along the southern coast, Margate, Ramsgate.
Still in martinets?
Yeah, still in martinets. I was having so many of them shot down by fighters whipping over from France, and because we was flying up and down the coast there with these, it was a sitting target, and I was shooting them down anyway.
And that was which squadron was that, sorry?
567.
And anything happened with them?
No, we lost a few martinets shot down, crashed, but apart from that, not a lot.
But no, you were never attacked?
No, I was never attacked, no.
Now, how long were you doing that?
I was doing that up to... up to the 14th of the 10th, 44.
So both those, you basically just lucky, nothing ever happened.
Nothing happened to them, no. I was really lucky because quite a lot of them got lost. But so there you are. That was me luck. I was having a run of luck there, wasn't I? And we had about 15 martinets, I think, on the squadron. We take off, driving up and down Beachy Head, all the way up to Dover, all along the coast there. And then these are heavy British, you know, okay, guns used to be firing us. But as far as you were concerned, nothing much happened.
No, not really. No.
What happens next then?
Next, I was posted to a bomber squadron, number 77 squadron, Full Sutton, Yorkshire.
Where, sorry?
Full Sutton, October 44, 14th of October 44. I went to Full Sutton.
How do you spell that, sorry?
Full Sutton, FULLSUTTON.
Sorry, it's as it sounds, yeah. And that's in Yorkshire, is it?
Yeah.
And with 77 Squadron.
What happened was there was a hell of a lot of problems with the fighters coming underneath and shooting the bombers down. They was coming underneath with two 40mm cannons at an angle of 45 degrees. And all they used to do, instead of, as they used to, stay on the beams and fire at the rear turret, they used to dive underneath and just open up, and the bomber had no chance whatsoever. So what they decided to do was put a .5 machine gun underneath in the belly. So when I was the first one to try it out. They made a hole, it was really a crash bang wallet. They made a hole in the bottom of the Halifax and put a fixed .5. And I had to go up and try it out. We went to 20,000 feet, but the slipstream and the cold air was you couldn't stand it, nor could the crew, because you can imagine there's a huge hole in the belly, and the slipstream was just pouring up, and it was a freezing cold, probably about minus 30, and the gun froze. I froze. Anyway, they gave it up. They never tried it no more. But while I was there, they came up to me and said, "We've got a daylight raid on Duisburg. We want a rear gunner for a daylight raid on Duisburg. The rear gunner's here, and would you take his place?" And that was on the 14th of the 44, and I'd done the daylight raid on Duisburg.
And what do you remember of that? Had anything changed? Fantastic. That's in the Halifax,
yeah,
isn't it?
That was fantastic, because when you think about it, it was only a few months previous when we used to bomb it in the day, in at night time. It was horrendous. Though the flak was still bad in the daylight, there was no fighters, because the British Spitfires and Americans were giving us protection all the way to Duisburg. But the flak was always there. And that was terrible. I don't know where they got all these men from to man these guns. There was millions of them.
And what was the date of that? That,
that was on the 14th of the 10th.
And anything happened, or was it just for you?
The only thing I know what happened, we was told to go in on a column. It's amazing, because you could see everybody. It was at 20,000 feet, and was to go in on a loop, do our bombing run, come back on the starboard and out. Apparently one bomber decided to cut across. He was probably late from his squadron, and he cut across. And as he cut across, as the bombers were going around like that, you could see he cut across. And I tell you what, it was 1, 2, 3, and there's smithereens in the sky. 3 shells, 1, 2, 3, bang. Blew him up completely. It's just because he crossed. Instead of standing with all the crowd with the silver paper we was dropping, he cut
windows.
Across. Windows, yeah. Instead of doing that, he just cut across. And it was 1, 2, 3. 3 shell bursts, the third one hit him, bang. It just blew up. A huge explosion. That's the one as my first raid on 77 Squadron.
So now was that meant you'd started a new tour?
I was set as a second new tour, yeah. And this is the second tour. Then we had another go at this .5, and we gave it up as hopeless. Until they could.
Was that a .5 Browning?
Yeah, .5 Browning, yeah.
It was manual. You had to use it manually. It was just slide. It was no help for hydraulic, but it was useless. The hole was too big and it was too cold. The crew couldn't stand it, nor could I. So we gave it another go, and then we slung it in. Apparently, there was an Australian squadron at Driffield, and they'd run out of rear gunners, and they asked 77 squadron if they could spare an experienced rear gunner to fly with them. And as I was there, I'd only just arrived there, they sent me there.
Is that permanently, or just for
permanently,
one?
Permanently, yeah.
So you were only with...
One trip.
You only did the one raid with 77 squadron.
Yeah.
And how did you feel about leaving the squadron?
Well, not got used to it, but I did find out as I went on that when they found out you was on a second tour, everybody was after you. Not that I was any different, but they knew I'd got had experience, and on a second tour, everybody was after you. And the trouble was, you usually ended up as a spare for different pilots, which was terrible, really, because you never knew who you was flying with, and sometimes it was more or less raw crews, and you was put in the back, and that was it. Anyway, I went with an experienced pilot.
Now, who's this squadron with? It's an Australian squadron.
It's actually an Australian squadron. 462. All Australians. Very few. Four or five. Well, I should mention about 15 or 16 English blokes. I mean, there's all Aussies. Even the ground crew were Aussies.
And where was it? Where were 462 based?
Driffield.
Now, what was your reception like joining an Australian unit? How did you fit? This is also in October, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, they called me a POM directly. I walked in. I was a WO then, but I found it was so much easier. So much. There was no discipline whatsoever. The officers and the NCOs mixed. It was in different, entirely different atmosphere. And on top of that, they used to get huge food parcels, cigarettes sent from Australia. And you couldn't believe when you went where you were in the sleeping quarters, the amount of stuff that was on the table was what they had sent from Australia.
So what, you weren't given a crew?
Yeah, when I got there, apparently this Flying Officer Horrigan, this is why I joined him, Flight Lieutenant Horrigan, who's an Australian, he'd got shot down over France the previous fortnight. He lost the crew, but he managed to get back to England.
Now, can you tell us that story? Because you tell me about how you haven't told me on tape though. What happened to Horrigan's crew?
Well, I don't know if they got taken prisoner or they were killed, but he survived. He was a skipper, and he made his way back.
But you haven't said how they were lost.
I can't remember. I don't know if a few of them were killed, because he crashed in unoccupied France. That's where he crashed. On the 29th of December, probably the British had taken that part of France, so that's where he crashed. I don't know how many of the crew were lost, but when I got to Driffield, he was just forming another crew.
Do you know his first name, Horrigan?
No.
If you can't remember, you can't.
No, I know he's at Horrigan. I'll see him in Australia. We're out there for a reunion. I'll see him out there, but